He said, "We saw them on the radar screen and we documented them. They are not bogies. They are not apparitions. They are real solid objects. And, of course, they would have to be in order to get a fix with radar." He documented 6 to 7 of them. Their speeds were estimated by the radar operators and their scopes between 3,800 to 4,200 miles per hour. These things were darting across the sky and suddenly they'd just come to a stop and do a 60-degree or 45-degree or 10-degree turn after stopping. And then immediately reverse this action. When I was working with the Skunk Works, we signed an agreement with the National Security Agency and the National Security Council, as well as the CIA. And we kept very quiet about things because they always knew where we were and what we were doing. I automatically had that team spirit. We were a big family there. And, I was very proud of that, having worked directly for Kelly Johnson. The anti-gravity propulsion systems. I heard it existed. But the left hand never knew what the right hand was doing, and for good reason. They didn't want us asking questions. We wanted to stay focused on the projects that we were working on. Testimonial. Graham Bethune is a retired Navy commander pilot with a top secret clearance. He was a VIP plane commander who flew most of the high-ranking officers and civilians from Washington, D.C. My name is Graham Bethune. I am a commander, retired pilot from the Navy, and I went through the regular Navy program of training pilots. All Navy pilots are trained navigators, which is very important because we had to know all of the star systems. When I graduated from Pensacola in 1943, I went to the South Atlantic to hunt German submarines. This was all night flying. In 1950 I was transferred to Air Transport Squadron 1 and sent to Keflavik, Iceland, along with two other officers after a meeting that they had in Washington, D.C., where Iceland was reporting multiple UFO sightings and were requesting troops, the Defense Department convincing them they were experimental Russian bombers. The flight was normally about 10 hours, but we had a 16-knot headwind. It was about 1 a.m. and we were 300 to 400 miles outside of Argentia, Newfoundland, when I saw something below the horizon on the water that looked like we were approaching a city at night. It was an ambient light, no definition whatsoever. I called my CO pilot's attention to it, who was route checking me. He took a look at it and he didn't know what it was either. We had already passed over the guard ship. In those days, they had a guard ship that sailed Iceland and Newfoundland. The weather was clear, there was no northern light activity, and we had ship plots. There were no ships plotted in that area. So we asked control if they could give us another fix and find out if we were really on course. We thought maybe we had drifted, that we were seeing Labrador or maybe the tip of Greenland. According to control, we were right on course. So we watched it for a while, drifting to the right of it. Our heading was 222 degrees, 225 degrees, our altitude at 10,000 feet. When we were about 25 or 30 miles away, we could see clearly defined lights and there was a pattern on the water. It was a circular pattern, and it was very large. Maybe the Navy was doing something that was highly classified, recovering something down in the ocean or something of this nature. So I sent the crew chief back to get Al Jones, the other plane commander, because they wanted to land at Argentia. There were 31 passengers on board plus two VIP crews that had pilots, and our patrol plane pilots. Standing behind me was the navigator, the radioman, and also the plane captain. The cockpit was full. At the time that they came forward, the lights went out on the water, we were now surrounded by complete darkness. And then a very small yellow halo appeared about 15 miles out. Suddenly, within a fraction of a second, it had rushed up 10,000 feet at us. I thought that it was going to go right through us. So I disengaged the autopilot, pushed the nose over, because I was going to go under it at the angle that it was coming toward me. The moment I did that, I could see nothing outside of the cockpit but this craft. I didn't know which way to go. And then I heard a racket. I yelled out, "Fred, what the hell was that?" He looked around and he said everyone was ducking in the back, scrambling on deck. I looked back and it wasn't there. And he said, it's over here on the right-hand side. The object was now about a mile or so away. It kind of drifted forward to a position 5 miles out, and it stayed there with us for quite some time. It was still above the horizon and you could see the side of the craft and its dome and you could see the color around the perimeter of the vehicle. By then we knew that it was a friendly encounter. We knew that it knew that we were there. We knew that it came out to see us. What we never thought about at the time was the reason they did this was because they wanted to show us what the Icelanders were talking about. We watched it for a while and then Al relieved me in the seat. He immediately disengaged the autopilot and was going to chase it. Now we had a headwind of about 60 knots, so our ground speed was only maybe 120 or 130 knots. Al wasn't going to go too far in chasing this thing. While Al chased after the UFO, I went back to see how the passengers were doing. I spoke to the physician first and asked him about what he had just seen. He looked me straight in the eye and said, it was a flying saucer. I didn't look at it because I don't believe in such things. Well, it took me a couple of seconds to realize what he was saying. Being a psychiatrist, he was forbidden to believe in these things. So I went back forward and I said, Al, whatever you do, don't tell anybody we saw anything, they will lock us up as soon as we get on the ground. He said, it's too late. I just called Gander Control to see if they could track this by radar. When we landed at Argentia, the Air Force was there to interrogate us. The captain who did the interrogation, you could tell this wasn't his first time that he had ever interrogated anybody as far as this type of encounter was concerned. He made a good report, which went to the headquarters of the Air Force in Washington, D.C. Initially the color of the UFO was yellow. Since then I've learned from the boys upstairs why we saw different colors as it was coming toward us. The colors were around the perimeter. It turned from a yellow to an orange to almost a fiery red, and then almost a purplish red. And they said that that had to do with the amount of energy being used or dissipated, with the power so to speak. So when it slowed down close to us, in a fraction of a second, it was back to the yellow range. And it was foggy around it to where it was like a plasma mist or something of this nature. When we were asked about the craft's size, 300 feet came to my mind. Years later, when I got the report out of the archives, everyone said it was anywhere from 250 to 350 feet in diameter. Now the velocity when it left us was estimated from between 1,000 and 2,000 miles an hour. When I looked at the report, Al Jones had estimated 1,800 miles an hour. Mine was 1,000 miles an hour, another's was 1,500 miles an hour, all in that range. The radar report said it was 1,800 miles an hour. At the time we had nothing that would go that fast. And of course I was at the Naval Air Test Center. This is where we had our test pilot training school. This is where we did all the highly classified tests of aircraft. And to my knowledge we had nothing anywhere near that speed or anything that was circular. This craft had covered 15 miles in about a second or two. When you calculate how fast it came toward us and suddenly stopped in front of us, you take something 300 feet in diameter, and you don't see much out of your cockpit window. When I went to set the automatic pilot back, the magnetic compass, which was in the center of the panel, was swinging back and forth. I said to Fred, "Did you see that?" He said, "You should have seen it when the craft was close, it was spinning." We looked at the other compasses when the craft was sitting out maybe 5 miles from us. We had what we called bird dogs. Low frequency radio components that will point to the station when you tune in the station. These two bird dogs were pointing toward the craft. We had two other compasses. We had a remote compass, which is out in the wing, it was reacting. There were a total of 5 different directional gyros in that airplane. Out of the 5, 3 of them were acting up. I was told that the UFO was tracked by radar and that the radar report was sent into the Air Force headquarters in Washington, DC, it usually goes from the to right Patterson Air Force Base. But my boss found the report in the archives in Wright Patterson in Project Blue Book after talking to Colonel Watson, and he confirmed the speed of 1,800 miles per hour. I said, "Where did you find that out?" He said, "Well, it was a radar report and it said that." So something happened to the radar report before they microfilmed it. Because what I have on microfilm I got from the archives, and the radar report is missing. I was told by a friend of mine at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base who I've known for years that they had allowed Steven Spielberg to see the microfilm and the Blue Book records on this for close encounters of the third kind. So he, Spielberg, had a pretty high clearance. He had to be associated with some of the, well, you know who, as far as the control group is concerned. The document that I found was the official document that the Air Force had put together. And it was originally filed under Project Grudge. But on the front page it says Project Twinkle, where they put a lot of reports that they had to get rid of somehow. There were 18 pages according to the archives. At that time, Admiral McCormick, who had relieved Eisenhower, was the NATO commander, the Supreme Allied Commander. His aides had approached me. Everybody seemed to know about this event. Like Admiral Radford, who became the first Joint Chief of Staff, his aides knew about it because he had talked to me about it. So there were quite a few who knew about this. Later in May, I had an intelligence officer come to the house and he showed me UFO crash photos, the first that I had ever seen. There was nothing, absolutely nothing there that looked close to it. There was one that was 100 feet in diameter. It didn't look like it was damaged too much. I asked him what happens to these reports. He told me, there is a Joint Intelligence Committee and they make the decision as to where it goes. They were coming to me a lot of times and showing me photographs. A lot of them looked like what we would call Foo Fighters. Like a round, bright disc of some kind. I was what you would call a VIP plane commander in the flag division, which flew most of the high-ranking officers and civilians out of Washington, D.C. Several of these officials told me what they had seen. For example, there were two craft flying together out in the Pacific. And a bright disc came up beside one of them and stayed with them for a while and flew around it. Our office came under the headquarters of Wright-Patterson. It was a central district. You had pilot meetings. I would go down there about once or twice a month to the meetings, plus I would go maybe two or three times a year for seminars. It would be a week or so. Once, while on the flight line where we parked our plane, we weren't too far from what looked like a corrugated metal hangar. And it was open most of the time. Every time my boss and I would go by there, he couldn't understand why I was not interested in going and looking at what was behind the metal wall back there. And he told me basically that they had a UFO craft back there. And he told me basically that they did have ET bodies there. He's not the first one that ever told me that. From discussions that he had had with Admiral Forney, who was our missile chief and had spent time at White Sands, he was convinced that craft from other planets were visiting us. He said Colonel Watson let him look at a lot of these files, plus he was the one that told him about what they had there, parenthesis, the ET craft and bodies, and he couldn't understand why I wasn't interested. I said, I don't have any interest because I will never be able to talk about it. From what I've seen, I know it was a craft at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base that crashed somewhere and the bodies that he was talking about were extraterrestrial. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists, and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals so that security and liberty may prosper together. President Dwight D. Eisenhower. January 1961. Of course the flying saucers are real, and they are interplanetary. Air Chief Marshal Lord Dowding, head of Royal Air Force during World War II. Quoted in Reuters, August 1954, UFO secret file The Eisenhower Years 1953-1961, Testimonials, A.H. Anonymous, Boeing Aircraft. Don Phillips, U.S. Air Force and Lockheed Skunk Works contractor, Philip Corso, Jr., son of Colonel Philip Corso, Sr., U.S. Army Intelligence Dr. B. is a scientist and engineer who worked on top secret projects. Commentary from Stephen M. Greer. The events at Roswell resulted in the acquisition of a living being, as well as many deceased members of an intelligent, interstellar species, along with several craft containing a wealth of advanced technologies that could be reverse engineered. Massive changes were underway. Within weeks of the Roswell event, the CIA was formed, along with the U.S. Air Force, which was split off from the Army Air Force. I have obtained a copy of a top-secret Canadian document dated November 21, 1950, written by W.B. Smith, a radio engineer, addressed to the Canadian Department of Transport. Smith states, I made discreet inquiries through the Canadian embassy staff in Washington who were able to obtain for me the following information. A. The matter, UFOs, is the most highly classified subject in the United States government, rating higher even than the H-bomb. B. Flying saucers exist. Dwight D. Eisenhower took office in 1953. Knowing he had to be proactive without involving Congress, Eisenhower enlisted the help of his friend, Nelson Rockefeller, a fellow member of the Council on Foreign Relations, to reorganize national security. With the Cold War in full swing, a revolution in Cuba, and the CIA placing the Shah of Iran in power, Rockefeller decided a new agency was needed that would be solely dedicated to UFO encounters while overseeing the incredible technologies that were being acquired through reverse engineering of these interstellar spacecraft. Majestic 12 was launched a year later as an independent agency operating on the black budget. From various sources, it appears its first members included Rockefeller, Secretary of Defense, Charles E. Wilson, CIA Director, Alan Dulles, Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Arthur Radford, and FBI Director, J. Edgar Hoover. There were also 6 men selected from the Council on Foreign Relations and 6 from the Jason Society, a scientific group formed during the Manhattan Project. Policies could only be mandated by a majority vote of 12, thus the name. By the end of the Eisenhower era, the UFO/ET projects were becoming increasingly compartmented away from a legal, constitutional chain of command oversight and control. First-hand witnesses have told us that the president was furious. This was a former 5-star general who had seen the ET spacecraft and bodies for himself, and yet suddenly he was now being kept out of the loop. President Eisenhower soon realized he had lost control of his Frankenstein's monster. Testimonial. A.H. is a person who has gained significant information from inside the UFO extraterrestrial groups within our government, military, and civilian companies. He has friends at the NSA, CIA, NASA, JPL, UNA, NRO, Area 51, the Air Force, Northrop, Boeing, and others. He once worked at Boeing as a surface technician. Basically, these projects were controlled by the Majestic 12 group, which is no longer called MJ-12. I'm trying to find out the new name of this group. My contact that worked at Area 51 knows the name of the group, but he's refusing to tell me the name. Parenthesis, note, MJ-12 has used the names Seca, Magic, PI-40, and now Magi. The Majority Intelligence Committee, basically, it's an oversight group intermingled with the National Security Council and the National Security Planning Group in Washington. DC Majestic 12 is intermingled with these people and the National Security Planning Group. They have full control. Presidents no longer have control over these groups. It's like a separate entity. The general accounting office doesn't know what's going on, they don't know where the money is going. They hide it all in black project operations. They don't want to release the information regarding where the ATs are coming from. But some of the locations are from Earth. There are underground bases here on Earth where the aliens have constructed bases a long time ago, before Columbus even discovered America, from what I understand. This information would cause a major upset. That's the kind of information that the NSA is worried about releasing. The NSA also collaborates back and forth with the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Organization, regarding tracking and intercepts, along with NORAD, the Air Force, and the Army. They are all in on it, and it's all connected with the top secret group called MAGI Control. MAGI Control is controlled by the Office of Naval Intelligence. It's a top secret collection group, like the Central Intelligence Agency and the NSA. In fact, the UN is just like the CIA. It's a top secret organization within the Navy. It's similar to the NSA and the SID. It's all encrypted information. They have agents out in the field, just like the CIA, collecting information. It's all very, very top secret. Testimonial. Don Phillips, U.S. Air Force, and contractor at Lockheed Skunk Works and the CIA, worked with Kelly Johnson at the Lockheed Skunk Works on design and construction of the U-2 and the SR-71 Blackbird. He was in the Air Force at Las Vegas Air Force Base during a major UFO event. We have records from 1954 that there were meetings between our own leaders of this country and ETs here in California. And, as I understand it from the written documentation, we were asked if we would allow them to be here and do research. I have read that our reply was, "Well, how can we stop you? You are so advanced." And I will say, by this camera and this sound, parenthesis, interview, that it was President Eisenhower who had this meeting. And it was on film, sort of like what we are doing now. The NATO report stated that there were 12 races. To make a final summary, they had to have contacts to go to these races in order to understand who they are, what they are doing, and what they could do. And the report didn't get into the context, but it certainly did verify that they haven't been here for just a few years, but rather hundreds, maybe thousands of years. And this is written in the text. Testimonial. Philip Corso Jr. is the son of Colonel Philip S. Corso, Sr., U.S. Army intelligence, who served on President Eisenhower's National Security Council. His father personally saw deceased extraterrestrials from the Roswell crash in 1947 and a UFO craft at an air base. While working in R&D, Corso Sr. was given fragments of extraterrestrial technologies from various crashes to seed industry with these technologies. In 1957, my father took command of the 552nd Missile Battalion. It was there that he experienced several encounters with extraterrestrials. The first took place in a cave in Red Canyon, an isolated area near White Sands, New Mexico. GIs had shown Dad to the cave in order to cool off. On this particular day, my father said he was kind of lying back, dozing off, when he rolled over, drew his gun, and pointed it toward this unrecognizable life form. Dad asked it, "Friend or foe?" And the form replied telepathically, "Neither." The being was wearing a helmet with a type of stone in the center of its head. It asked my father to shut down his radars for 15 minutes. Dad was thinking, "How does this thing know that I'm the only person that could give the command to shut those radars down?" He asked the AT, "Why should I do it? What's in it for me?" The being again answered telepathically, "A new world, if you can take it." At the time, the reply had little meaning to my father. Still, he went out of the cave and called Sergeant Rex and told him to shut down the radars. As he was leaving, Dad saw the ET standing at the end of the cave, and it did a kind of gesture with its hand that wasn't a salute and wasn't a wave or anything, but Dad saluted him back. That was basically the end of the first encounter. But later on that year, the 552nd Missile Battalion's radars picked up a ship moving over 3,000 miles an hour through the atmosphere. It went down near Red Canyon. Dad had a light airplane on the base. He got the pilot and they flew over the area where they saw a shiny object on the ground. Dad decided it might be best if he investigated it by himself, so he ordered the pilot to return to the base. Then he got one of the old staff cars, went out into the desert and relocated the craft himself. It was perfectly smooth and oval-shaped, only more like a cigar than a saucer. It was stuck sideways against a rock and would fade out completely and then fade back in. Dad thought he was hallucinating. He managed to throw a tumbleweed beneath it before it faded out. When it phased back in again, the tumbleweed was crushed, so he knew it was physical. He also told me there were footprints around the craft. I always felt like there was more to this story that my father kept to himself. You don't see footprints near a craft without having a second encounter. That's just my personal opinion. My father said the ship suddenly began to vibrate. He got scared and jumped back in the staff car and threw it in reverse. The vehicle went flying backwards and the motor stalled. Meanwhile, the ET craft rose up in the air, turned, and then it went into an envelope that it kind of folded into. Dad later told Wernher von Braun and Hermann Oberth what happened. Both men were on his scientific teams. He knew them because he had been in charge of Operation Paperclip. Paperclip was the covert program the United States used to bring select Nazi scientists into America after the end of World War II. My father discussed these issues with a select group of people, including Senator Strom Thurmond, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, CIA leaders, all branches of the services, the intelligence community, and several of the chiefs of staff. And yes, later he kept the information from several US presidents. My father said the secrecy regarding the UFOs and ETs was shared by himself and the 30 generals that were in charge, General Trudeau among them. They all knew it was Stalin's number one goal to steal Roswell technology, and they were determined not to allow this to happen. So they began an operation to hide it. They felt that the CIA was infiltrated. They feared their funding would one day be cut off and that nothing would be done with this technology if they left a paper trail. And so there was no written mandate, just an oath taken among these battlefield-hardened officers. I guess an oath taken among men you have served with is probably just as good as if you signed it with the Lord. I know my father never talked to anyone about this stuff. I'm positive. After General Trudeau passed on, my father covered a lot in his book. That was the deal. The last man standing could tell. Not a word was said before 1992. Testimonial. Dr. B. is a scientist and engineer who worked on top-secret projects involving anti-gravity, chemical warfare, secure telemetry and communications, extremely high-energy space-based laser systems, and electromagnetic pulse technology. I was born in 1943. My dad was a world-renowned scientist. He worked with Henry Ford and Howard Hughes. So I came from the Lucky Sperm Bank Science Club. At 9 years of age, I was working on science projects with the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. I left Michigan when I was 15 years old. The government came down and they wanted me in the Air Force. They took me to Little Rock when I was 16 and kept me right outside this army base that was responsible for chemical and germ warfare. When I was 17, I went into the military and was trained at Lackland Air Force Base, and then went on to Keesler, then to the United States Armed Forces Institute and the Early Warning Radar at Point Arena. We had an ANFPS-35 radar. It is 9 stories tall with a 466-foot antennae and its power was 5 megawatts, which is way lower than HAARP. And its range was 455 miles. That was all classified information at that time. It was what's called a search set. We'd look out every night over Northern California and thousands of bogies, parenthesis, UFOs, would come down about 20 miles out from Point Arena. And they come down at 20,000 miles an hour. They'd go down just about to Baja and then they would turn left and go across Mexico, where they were seen going 5,000 miles an hour almost every night. We had a room with what were called PPI scopes, planned position indicator scopes. If something went wrong with the equipment, I just went in to troubleshoot it and fix it.